Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that being said, I would love to introduce Rosa Mira from Proyecto Titi.
Hi, Neil. It's so great to be talking to you today. Happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad to be speaking to you, Rosa Mira. And I'm super excited for all of our listeners to learn more about yourself and Proyecto Titi. I'd love for you to just give them a brief introduction so they know what we're talking about today.
Okay, for me or for the project or both?
For you, yeah, just a quick rundown of yourself and the project, and then we can jump into our chat.
Okay, so I am a conservationist that works to protect one of the rarest and cutest monkeys of the world, the little cotton-top tamarins. They only live in Colombia, country of Colombia in South America, and I was born and raised there. But I took a different path at the beginning of my life. I was trained as an architect. I loved the outdoors, so I got a master's in landscape architecture. And when I came back to Colombia after getting my master's, my first job was redesigning a zoo in my local hometown. And that's the first time I saw a cotton-top tamarin at the zoo. I had to do some research to design their new exhibit and learn they were only found in my background, in my, you know, in my back path, in my backyard.
Garden. Back is the yes, word. Back, backyard, back garden, yes.
Yeah, and I was really amazed to learn that they existed because I never knew. And I was amazed to know that I didn't know about him. So
what an incredible introduction for you, you know, coming in from the architecture side, coming into the zoo being, oh, I'm going to design exhibits. I'm going to design like, you know, enclosures, and then saying, oh, wow, like, what is this animal? I'm super fascinated.
Exactly.
So what from that moment, what was your journey to then becoming a conservationist?
Well, because that's a funny thing of life that brings you to paths that not necessarily you planned. But in my case, I became the zoo's landscape architect, right? And I did that for a little while. But one of those weird turns in life, I ended up being appointed as the zoo director. And I was already in love with the monkeys. And I said, oh, well, this is my chance to create awareness about cotton tops. So I made cotton top tamarins the symbol or like the host species of the zoo and started doing a lot of awareness.
They're like symbolic species that people are going to come to this zoo to see.
Yeah, yes. see the monkeys and learn from it and understand that they're only found here. Make them special because this is the only place on earth you will see them in the wild. So to me, that's like, this is my opportunity to create awareness. And that's how I got connected with a small group called Proyecto Titi that was working very close to the zoo on protecting the animals in the wild. And then I decided to leave the zoo a few years after that and have dedicated the last 20 years to protecting the species and, you know, and to making sure they have a safe future.
Amazing. I would love to talk a bit about the organization. So Proyecto Titi honors the, so you're honoring this cotton top tamarin.
Exactly.
And this is because, so the Titi part of it is, it's the local name, right? The local name for the cotton top tamarin. So, you know, we've talked about you making this, you know, this sort of like flagship species of the zoo, and also like that's what drew you into the conservation for it. But how is this kind of served as the driver for Proyecto Titi, as the driver for protecting, you know, Colombia's species, their dry tropical forest? How has that been you know, the driver.
Right. In a personal way, I was born and raised in a large family. I am the youngest of 10 kids. But both my parents...
Oh, my dad is also...
Well, you know what? We were 8 brothers and 2 girls. And we got picked on a lot. So I learned to survive from age and to also tackle tough causes, you know. But just as a joke. But no, my parents were both educators. So my mom was a preschool teacher and my father was a high school teacher. But my father was he taught philosophy and grammar and Spanish. So he was very, you know, very deep in the way that we all should find a path that has meaning and purpose in life. And when I made that connection between what I aspired for my personal career and my personal life and the opportunity to save a species from extinction, it was a very strong connection and a great motivator to dedicate my life to that, even though in the beginning I wasn't trained as a scientist or a conservationist. But I welcomed the opportunity, found a lot of motivation. My skills that I had developed by being the zoo director were very helpful starting the project and the organization.
Do you know what I love about that, if I can just quickly interject, is that going down this path, it shows that, you know, conservation is accessible. You're not sort of grounded by your chosen career path, or there are so many avenues for you to take on tangents in your life, and also like tangents where you can start to make impact, like yourself. You know, who would have thought that now in 2025, when you were studying architecture, you'd be going around saving a species or working towards conservation?
You couldn't be so right, Neil, because that's exactly what I share in my talks and when I talk to people, is that conservation needs all sorts of views and perspectives, because it's not only the science, it's not only the biologists studying the species, it's also the educators, it's also the legal advisors, it's also the policymakers, it's also communications, it's also telling your story. So you need a lot of different skills. So it is conservation.
Do you know what? It's incredible. You've spoken about all these different aspects, and I think it's crucial for like people to realize that, you know, scientific research is not enough. You have to have this interconnectedness of all of these areas that you've spoken about. Now, when it comes to the foundation, Proyecto Titi, like when and how did you guys come around this, you know, this knowledge sector of saying, okay, this isn't enough to save these species, we have to start expanding out? Talk us through the journey of that.
Yeah, so it's about like when we were getting the organization started 20 years ago, there were people already studying the species. Dr. Ann Savage, who's an American biologist, started doing some research for her PhD dissertation a few years back. And we connected through the zoo because she was involved in zoos in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We connected while I was the director of the zoo. And by that time, she and a couple of people in her team were conducting the first population survey of cotton tops in northern Colombia. They are only found in a bubble in northern Colombia, very restricted distribution, right? So they wanted to confirm how many were left and how, you know, how well their forest, their habitat was doing. So that was around, you know, 2005 or so, 2005. So when the results of that population survey came out, that's when we realized how dramatic the situation was. Now to the IUCN, which is the International Authority for Species Conservation, and to the ministry in Colombia to make a case for cotton tops and say, listen, there's only about 8% of the forest for these monkeys, and their numbers are going down really fast because the forest is going away to give way to cattle ranching, agriculture, mining, and people are hunting these animals to keep them as pets. So we need to call attention. We need to, you know, make an alarm call for this species before it disappears. So they both accepted to put cotton tops or to classify them as a critically endangered species, which is like the highest classification
rating on the IUCN, that this animal
before they go extinct of the wild. So we still have time. So we thought of that. And then after that, after we achieved that in around 2008 in 2010 for Colombia, then we got on a rampage to, okay, let's just work to protect forests, to restore forests, and to educate people so they don't have them as pets.
That's incredible. You know, the amount of effort it takes to actually get these processes moving forward, you know, to get national recognition to say, look, our endemic species, our local species is, we're losing it. You know, it's only found in this select area. All of these problems going on around it. We need to first instigate this, get that ticked off, and then start making changes so we can, you know, start protecting this species.
Exactly.
Since that time, you know, you're talking about 2008, you said 2010, roughly.
Yeah.
Now, it's been 15 years since then. You know, climate change, for example, is consistently changing weather patterns, rainfall patterns, specifically in areas like Colombia's Caribbean region. Like, we're looking at, for example, what's going on at the moment in Jamaica. You know, they're experiencing more and more frequent hurricanes, more and more radical hurricanes. These are all counter effects of climate change. But these are also affecting species. They're affecting things like the cotton-top tamarind's habitats, their food sources. I'd love to kind of know, what are the strategies that Proyecto Titi is implementing, you know?
Yeah. So just like you said it, you first need to have a scientific basis. The science is very important. It's not the only thing, but it's very important.
Yeah. You have to have an understanding of, okay, what's the numbers, the populations, where are they found, what are they feeding on, what's their reproduction rate like? You know, there's so many things. You know, what is their immune systems like? Like, are there new diseases in the area? There's so much you have to consider.
Exactly, but that is the base. Yeah. But is the different thing as conservationists is that you don't only do this science for the science. You do it to get information so that you can use it to protect the species. And that is, when you're asking about climate change, that is certainly a huge issue for cotton tops. Cotton top tamarins, their habitat, their forest, is what we call a tropical dry forest, because it's different from the Amazon because it doesn't rain every day. There's 6 months that you get a lot of rain, but there's 6 months that get no rain. And in that period, cotton tops and other animals have a hard time finding food, but it's part of their life. So they're used to it. They're adapted to it. But when the climate shifts and the dry seasons extends, then there's a problem. And it is a problem also, not because they have, you know, very little food and they have to rely mostly on insects. Thank God they eat insects and sap from trees because they have something to rely on when they don't have fruits, because most of the trees drop their leaves and their fruits. But the other thing is that their fertility, their ability to reproduce, is directly tied to the availability of food, like in many animals. So if you have food, your body's ready to reproduce. But if you don't, you don't. Then if we continue to have those extreme patterns that we have seen in a few years over the last decade, then that may become a problem in the future. So we're trying to get ahead a little bit, at least locally, because our impact is more on the municipality kind of range. We are hoping to grow at a regional level. But right now, you know, we're learning as we go that it does make a difference. And the great thing is that people, farmers, they recognize that when they have forest in their property, they have more water for their cows and for their farm animals over time. And the dry season is less and less strict on them. So it takes time to prove it, to show it, to understand it, and to change it. And that's what we're trying to do. So we're trying to counterbalance those patterns and try to make like a local microclimate that helps animals, helps people, and that it proves that when you have trees, you have water, and it's welfare for everybody. So that's the kind of approach we're taking, combining.
That is incredible and sounds so interesting. And I cannot wait to dive into that right after we have our first break to hear from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Rosa Mira from Proyecto Titi. Now, we just left off learning about the incredible journey of Rosamira from being a landscape architect into now becoming one of Colombia's leading conservationists, working to protect, save, and get their numbers back up of the cotton-top tamarind. So we just spoke about, prior to the break, how climate change is altering rainfall patterns in Colombia and how it's affecting the cotton-top tamarind. But that is just one angle of what is affecting this species, because, you know, there's things like deforestation. And even beyond that, the cotton-top tamarinds, they're facing threats from, or have in the past, from the illegal pet trade and biomedical use. You know, I think I read something about 20 to 30,000 were captured in the 60s and the 70s. And guys, that actually wasn't that long ago. You know, we've got fewer than, I think, 7,000 remaining. Now, you touched upon this just before the break, you know, addressing all of these multiple threats simultaneously. I'd love for you to walk us through, you know, what are the most pressing things affecting them at the moment, and how Proyecto Titi's work has, you know, been successful in some cases of, you know, moving the strides forward.
Yeah. So there is two main threats that cotton-top tamarins are facing, and many other animals, but our focus is cotton-tops. And one is deforestation. But deforestation goes along with fragmentation, which basically means that you cut tracts of forest and isolate forest patches. And for, you can imagine that for a species that always hangs out up in the trees, you know, never come down to the ground because they become vulnerable, right? It makes it hard for them to find food and shelter and to grow their populations. So deforestation, so less forest, fragmented forest, that's a big problem. And the other problem is that it's so cute. It's a beautiful animal about the size of a squirrel with a white, you know, shock of white hair that looks like somehow like Einstein or like a rock star. They're very pretty, very charismatic to the human eye. And people think it's fun to have them as pets. So there's a lot of traffic associated for the illegal pet trade that still goes on, even though, you know, we're working to reduce it. So we tackle those two threats mainly. And one is science and policy and protection, working with the authorities, working with different strategies to protect and restore the forest and connect it, right? Connect it. And the other like line of work is all social work, education and awareness and community projects for people, because somebody in a rural area of Colombia, you know, that is facing poverty, if they have an option to sell a cotton top and feed their families for a week, they will do it. You know, survival for them is first, of course, like it is for all of us. And so we try to provide alternatives, income alternatives that reduce that threat. So those are the main threats. And our work is focused on reducing those threats, like you mentioned before, with different approaches, different strategies. So we can chat a little bit about each of them, but like the strategies for protecting the forest at the beginning, when we realized it was really, really bad, less than 8%, what we did is try to protect what was left. So we worked with the environmental authorities, and over the past 10 years, working with the regional authorities, we've been able to protect like the most important forest fragment that were still left. And I think it comes up to probably a little over 13,000 acres in two states that we've been able to protect. It doesn't sound like much land for...
No, that's like, a lot. That's incredible.
At least it has already a designated as protected area. That's good. But then we've also purchased land ourselves and have created...
Oh, wow.
By a national park. So the national park is about 2,500 acres, and we have purchased another 2,500 acres. So now the conservation area is much bigger. Mm-hmm. But some of these...
Yeah. So that, you know, that they have that one area where they can continue to thrive.
Yeah, at least they can thrive. In some of these plots that we have purchased were used for cattle ranching. So now we have to bring back the forest. And that is why we have learned, basically, because there's no book that tells you how to rebuild the forest, a tropical dry forest. So we've learned how to rebuild a forest based on all the science we've done in the past. And so we're kind of recovering these areas. But there's a third strategy. and it is to work with the local farmers and you know, kind of offer them an agreement. So like if I come to you, Neil, and I say, Neil, you have this beautiful piece of land, you're using it for cattle ranching and for agriculture. How about if you designate 10% of it, just 10% of it, along the creek to create a forest corridor that connects two forest fragments? And yeah, what do I get for that? Well, you'll get support from rent. What do you need? No, I need a water collection system. I need a solar panel. I need seeds for producing more products. And okay, yeah, we'll help you with that. But then you commit in the long term to create, to let us come and plant trees, and you protect these trees. So those agreements are going really well. You know, we've been doing this for 10 years with other organizations in the area. They're getting their benefits. We're getting our benefits. And it seems to be working right. And those corridors are the ones created to connect the protected areas. So it's like a three-way strategy. Protect whatever there is, restore what's new and is being created as a forest, and connect those forest areas. And the great thing about that, Neil, is that in that process, you can involve a lot of people and provide jobs, provide, you know, better livelihoods. So there is a big social component to doing this, not only the ecological component. And what we want to show is that everybody gets a benefit from conservation. I mean, we don't have to see conservation as a roadblock that doesn't allow development. We have to see it as an opportunity to do things in a better way. And that's, I think that's the way conservation should be looked at, and not, you know, people tying themselves to trees to, you know, to avoid development, because we all need food and we all need resources for our day-to-day living. So that's...
Yeah, it's about that collaborative learning, you know, okay, so we're an impasse here, but how do we move forward together, you know, rather than butting heads, like actually moving forward in a direction together that we can be mutually beneficial for you looking after the species or them trying to, you know, make something financially viable to help the economy to produce jobs, you know, how can we intertwine those things? You've mentioned some work with the communities. Now, some organizations that I've spoken to before, you know, working with these rural communities, they have a lot of traditional knowledge, specifically when it comes to things like conservation. Have you at Project with T2 come across, you know, organizations or groups that have this traditional Colombian knowledge when it comes to conservation or their ideas or thoughts around protection of this animal? And have you found like mutual ways to work together for solutions?
Yeah, it hasn't happened. I mean, like in the area where we work, there is no existence of like long tradition indigenous communities. These are farmer communities. I mean, long-term farming communities.
Okay.
But what we have learned in all the process of restoring the forest, they have a lot of experience. They know the plants. They know how to germinate. I don't know. I mean, that's the local knowledge they have brought to the table that has been very valuable. In fact, we have one of our field assistants that is working for us, or has been working for us for the last 8 years. He used to be a logger for 20 years as a business because he didn't have anything else to feed his family from. He couldn't finish high school. He had, you know, a high school sweetheart got pregnant and he had to go work to provide for his family. It is for 20 years.
This guy has a lot going on.
He knows a lot, the trees, the value of the trees, how to move them, how to cut them, how to, you know, so we tease him and tell him, you know, you have a lot to make up for, man, after 20 years, but here's your opportunity. You can now grow and plant trees and care for the monkeys. And he has become a great assistant.
You know, when you're talking about the logging here, can you talk our listeners through what the logging industry is and what it was doing in these areas? You know, just so you can paint a picture of, you know, helping their understanding.
It is mostly, I mean, beyond cutting a forest for putting in cows, there's a lot of selective logging because the tropical dry forest has some trees that are very valuable commercially, very good wood, very good lasting wood. So there's at least 15 different tree species that people would love to cut the large trees and sell the wood because you don't get termites to eat it. They are very good with the, here in this region, there's a high humidity, high temperature. So everything rots. And some of these woods are so tough that they would never rot. And they want them to build furniture, doors, fences.
Yeah. You can see the draw there. And there's a lot of money involved in these industries. Yeah. If you think you've spoken about all of these different products. Now, when I was looking into your organization, you guys have been looking for alternatives, you know, to work with some of these communities of ways that they can make money out away from the logging, right? Like away from these traditional industries. And I saw that you had a eco mochila program where you're turning plastic bags into, you know, hand crocheted tote bags. I'd love for you to talk our listeners through what kind of sprouted the ideas there and everything going on with this program.
Exactly. Just like you said it, Neil, there's big industries behind everything that is illegal, right? But in our case, most of the local communities are not part of like big networks of illegal stuff. They are just trying to make a living.
So yes, absolutely. They're like, that's the job I can do. That's the job available. So I need to survive. Yeah.
That's the only thing that pays. But okay, how about if we bring different ideas to you? And one of those that came about a few years ago was the Eco Mochilas. As we were meeting with women in one of the local communities where we work, and we were just kind of like playing around. It's like, what can we do with something that you don't have to invest too much money, you know? And then there was one person that did crochet, and she started just funneling with the little thread of plastic. And we were all like, this is interesting. What can we do with this? And then it came about with the idea of recycling plastic bags and making these beautiful eco mochilas. The first few ones that they made were not that pretty, but they really did very well.
It's a learning curve, you know, growth, both creativity and understanding the structure of the bag. Like, how are we turning this one bag into something better?
So
no, but you've also had incredible impact with that, from what I was seeing.
Yes, lots of plastic bags, because it started growing. We, at some point, we had like 300 women crocheting. And then, you know, like any other business, it has ups and downs, but we have a group, I think it's around probably 50 women that have remained busy with this project. Of course, all the marketing effort is on our end to sell the products, but also we have been able to connect them with designers, local designers, fashion designers, and also with the governor's office. So they are invited as artisans to events, sell their products.
No, but it's so innovative because I love the cascade effect. You know, you're saying, look, here is the problem with the communities only having access to jobs in the logging industry or jobs that are almost anti-conservation that are causing further problems. Now you're saying you've come to the community and you've seen, okay, how can we work with these locals to provide them a way to be, you know, self-sufficient, still be attributing towards the economy, but also, you know, have livelihoods that they can support their families.
Exactly.
That's
what we're looking for. It's just a different alternative.
Yes, exactly. But it didn't stop there. You were like, okay, you found a way to then take another product, another problematic product, which is the plastic bag, and then create it into something, you know, beautiful and creative. And it's almost this like three-pronged model, which has, you know, just like continues rolling forward. Honestly, I just think it's such an incredible way to have looked at a problem that most people would think like, okay, I'm stuck in this cycle, or I'm stuck, this is the only thing that we can do. It's like, no, there are so many ways that you just need that one push or that one organization or individual to have that spark of an idea to say, wow, like this is, we can make change here. We can start moving towards a positive.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're looking for. And we know that some of these projects have limited impact with regards to how many people you can benefit.
Yes, but, of course.
That's why we come up with different things. So we that was such a great experience that we then turned into inviting another group of artisans to make plush toys, to make the little cotton top plush, right? And then and then another idea came about. Those are still very popular. So they make like keychains, they make the cotton tops, they make the long hands, all sorts of like pins and things to your hair. And then there's another group of about 10 women in another community that are working through that. Then we came up with the idea of For a while, we did that. COVID put a hold on it, but we collected plastic bottles and turned them into fence posts. And we still do some of those, but not so extensively. Instead of cutting trees for fences in these rural areas, you can use the fence posts. We call them TT posts. Those are very successful too. And then we came up, you know, you got to keep coming up with ideas so that you can engage more people. And one thing very important.
You had a clay stove one as well, right?
That project phased out because finally these communities got natural gas pipes. So then they could cook with natural gas instead of firewood. But yes. We had the bindes that mimicked a termite mound. And they were so effective in reducing the amount of firewood that you needed to use instead of 50.
I love the relationship that you guys have developed with these communities. Yeah. You know, it's beautiful to hear.
No, they have turned into great friendships. She's also like nice. You kind of make a lot of friends, and you can talk honestly. They're there too, because that's one thing that is important to highlight. These rural communities in our country have been abused many, many times over by, you know, politicians, by projects, by, you know, big investors. And they become very skeptical. They don't trust. They don't believe. So it takes time to build a relationship, a trust relationship for them to understand that you want to help and that you're there for good. I mean, you're going to be there. You're going to be around until they need you. And that has been very important. And I would recommend something is just be there for the community for a while. Don't just come in, do your thing and never see you again, because they need the support and the help. And then you become friends and you become, you know, you end up being the godmother of one of the kids of your artisan.
I love that.
You celebrate the quinceañera party when their kids are old. So it becomes a very...
it's passionate. It's intertwined. It's, you know... You're having incredible cascades of effects. And on that note, I'm going to leave our listeners to think about how they can participate in community and community impact, maybe even right there in their own homes. And we'll be right back after this short break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Rosa Mira from Proyecto TT. We just left off speaking about the incredible work that the organization has been doing with local communities and working in conjunction with them, rather than coming in as an external organization thinking they have all the solutions, but instead working in partnership with these local areas to instill a sense of autonomy in their work, from their Eco Mochila programs, from their now sunsetted clay stoves that reduced firewood. And it sounds like they have benefited personally and financially and through conservation through these incredible relationships that they've developed. I want to bring it back for a second to the cotton top tamarind. And earlier in our conversation, Rosa Mira spoke about the pet trade. And I would really love to just touch base on that, because, you know, people, like you said, they like keeping them as pets because they're cute or they have that appeal. But How do we go about educating people about the problems of why they shouldn't be keeping these endangered species, you know, in an environment that's endangering them?
Right. Yeah. Well, Neil, that has also been a learning curve for us, because, you know, when you're passionate about something, you think or you feel that everybody should be as passionate as you are, but we all humans think and want different things. But there's something that we all share, and it's emotions. You know, we share the same emotions. So what we have learned is, like, with the children, you know, and we've had education programs in the local schools for over 15 years. So what we do is like, we have, right now we have three conservation impact areas where there's forests, there's monkeys, and there's communities around it. So in those communities, they have schools. Kids go to school. So we work with those schools and they allow us to come and implement our programs. But what has, you know, we have come down to one of our most successful programs, a traveling puppet show. And this puppet show tells a story about a monkey and a kid that goes into the forest to learn about the monkeys. And they start interacting on things they like and they don't like. And then
the kid is having a conversation with the monkey.
They're having a conversation. He says, "Oh, I would love to have a cricket right now." And the girl says, "Cricket? Well, I don't love crickets. I would love to have a hot dog." And he goes, "Ugh, hot dog. I don't hate that. I want a cricket and I want a fruit." And so they start kind of like, you're kind of interacting. And then at some point, the cotton tub says, "Yes." And they took my brother away from our family. And so the kid goes like, "What? Why? So you understand how terrible it is to be separated from your family, to be in a place you don't
know. It's about having that connectivity.
You connect directly to the heart. And then kids...
Who are these shows targeted at? Who is watching these?
We're going to the schools in usually elementary school, like fourth, fifth grade, sixth grade. We go to that and we go to open, you know, sometimes we go to community fairs, we go to community celebrations and present it's a half an hour puppet show, but it's got a lot of games afterwards. So you connect emotionally. When you connect emotionally, there is a change in your perception. And kids truly understand, because we evaluate pre and post. And we know that kids, after being in the puppet show and playing and working with us, they understand that the only place...
You're looking ahead. You're saying, okay, in the next 10 years, the next 20 years, these are the people who could either be propagating and, you know, extending this pet trade industry, or they're going to be the people that actually put it to an end because they have that education, that realization that this is not good.
That's exactly. And we're tracking the numbers to make sure that we can document that happening because of these programs that we're doing, investing in little kids. But we also do the same with the old people. I mean, older people, with us adults, because if they want
to... We still need educating. We definitely do, 100%. And I hope people are being educated today by listening to the show.
Exactly. You can be the future ambassadors to this. No, but listen, I see it in my case. I grew up, and in my mid-20s is when I came to learn about cotton tubs. I never had them as pets, but people had them as pets that I knew, right? So so now when you come to realize that, but nobody told you. So some of these farmers have seen cotton tubs there. They think they exist all around the world, and they're okay because they see that they are okay in their parcel. Yes. But they didn't know they're only Colombian. They're very endangered. So when you start sharing that information, that's like, wow, I didn't know they only lived here in my country, in my region.
I know what you mean. Do you know what? I think especially you've spoken about getting in and talking to these children and educating them at quite a young age. I was very proactive in my learning as a kid, and I always had deep empathy and connection with conservation. That's why I ended up becoming a biologist and working within this field. But I remember I was on holiday with my family in Mexico, and there was someone who had like a squirrel monkey who was performing as part of a show, you know, just one of the street performers. And I was devastated. I was just really frustrated at the fact that this monkey was chained up, you know, performing day in, day out with the street performer. And I remember turning to my mum, and my mum was like super excited to see this cute little monkey. And I was thinking, oh God, there's such like a vast amount of separation between my mindset and her mindset. But it's more because I've taken the time to learn and study and understand why this isn't right, why this isn't healthy for either of us or the public in general. But it's about, you know, not widening those gaps, about bringing them together. It's about bringing and deepening that understanding between us. I think that is very, it's incredible.
It's a lot. I mean, again, it's exactly what you're saying. You felt empathy, but, you know, for older generations, that was just like common, you know, to have animals, to go to circus and see animals perform. But thankfully that has changed, and the new generations have a different view of things. And we have less and less of those spectacles in our world. But also there is, I mean, beyond the awareness, there's also a commitment. So if you want to do plush toys and you want to profit from plush toys that we will sell, you have to make a commitment to help us care for these monkeys. And you cannot have them at home. And if you see anything weird happening, you will let us know so that we can manage with the authorities. And you'll become an ambassador and a protector of Cotton Tops.
Yeah.
And you will teach
getting all of these eyes in the community and with the
exactly.
people.
You're like, eyes oh, in the community. Yes. And it's been very effective because, and that's something else we've learned along the way, is like when people have something stable that they can rely on and to provide for their families, they're more willing to, they are willing to work with you, and they get aware and they want to help because they think the cause is beautiful. They believe and trust us, but they also are seeing the tangible benefits on their pockets. And that is the basic thing. It's hard to conserve if you're hungry and if your kids are hungry.
Yes. And you know what? I think that's the biggest thing, you know. What really frustrates me about this these conversations around environmentalism, climate, and conservation is that they're very dominantly led by Western bodies. And these are people who have been propagating the effects and extending the effects of climate change, deforestation, water pollution, all of these things. But they are not the people who are experiencing the cascade effects of it. And also those that are on the lower end of the economic spectrum that are having to deal with the reality of what these things are in their day in and day out lives. What I would love to just come back to on that note is, you know, we've spoken about a lot so far. With Colombia in general, it's still very volatile in the sense when it comes to deforestation. There was a surge in 2016, even though you had been working with this, working with getting the cotton top tamarin classified as critically endangered in 2008-2010. This is 6 years past that point. You know, there's always going to be issues with governments coming in and out. But I would love to hear from you what gives you hope that the species can recover and continue to thrive in Colombia.
Yes, it gives me hope that we're working from the bottom up. So if locals are happy and understand and value having a little forest in their property, you know, doing crops that are, you know, good for them, good for the animals, and they're happy with it, then it's going to be there's a better chance that this perpetuates over time without us being there. So the model that with other organizations, because we didn't come up with it. So other organizations that we work in partnership with.
I don't think it matters if you came up with it or not. You're running with it and you're doing well.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of like give credit to our other partners that have contributed to this.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it is a model that makes sense and it's working. It's been working for 10 years. And if people, you know, if we are successful in instilling that value, awareness, and making sure they have benefits, you know, we might not need to be there over time. That would be our ideal. Mm-hmm. But it gives me hope because I have seen that happen. When people have a sustainable way to provide for their families, they help you conserve. Because these are people that have lived in the farms, in the outdoors, in the rural areas. They value it. They love it. And you know what's amazing, Neil, is that, you know, city in mind, that you want to have a big house with, you know, lots of money to travel and do stuff and buy stuff, right? But these people in the local communities, they just want to provide for their families. They want to put food on the table every day. They want to be able to send their kids to school. They want to be able to celebrate Christmas and whatever, you know, their families, religions and celebrations they have, and just be able to have fun. You know, not suffer and then have to eat once a day.
Yes.
But there's no more
thriving in their lives. That's what they want.
It's very basic. You don't need that much. So when you see that and see that conservation can provide that opportunity, that makes me hopeful.
What would you say is Proyecto Titi's proudest achievement, whether in recent years or throughout the span of the organization?
I think we have probably like three like key points in time. One of them was certainly have enough science to classify the species as a critically endangered. That was a big achievement back then. Then soon after that, in one of our locations where we work, somebody came up with an idea of building an airport between two big cities. And that would have wiped off completely that piece of forest, which is one of the most conserved forest areas with cotton tops. And actually, the media was the one that helped us get the word out and make a big fuss out of it when the project was just starting. I think it was a good timing that we came up with this fuss when the project was just being presented to the national government. And we were one of the reasons why they turned down the project because you know, we talked a lot about critically endangered species, this being one of the very few remnants of forest. Making a case for cotton tufts was another big achievement for us. But I would say the most recent one is just the forest we have protected and the forest we have restored, or we are restoring. And then we're starting to see the change of those pastures coming into forest, turning into forest. That's beautiful. That gives me hope too. I mean, of course, the scale of it, we would love to, you know, amplify it. But you first need to learn how to do it right, and then you can replicate. But I think having a protocol to bring back the forest, to connect it and to protect it, and in that way, involving the local farmers and the local people is something that I really want to amplify and replicate in many other places and make it as successful as we have been able to see it here. But, you know, having our reserve, learning how to restore the forest, focusing on forest, on the habitat, has been a big shift and a very meaningful one.
What would you say to, let's say, a listener who's listening to us today and they go, oh, well, what's so important? It's just one tiny, tiny primate. I would love, you know, for you to just tell those people who are skeptical about this why these primates are important for Colombia's entire biodiversity.
Yeah. So in our case of us Colombians, so if there's Colombian listeners, it is a unique species. It only lives here. We're tapping into the sense of pride and appropriation, you know, and then you want to protect what's yours, what you feel engaged with, your culture, your patrimony. That's one reason. That's one little more abstract reason. But we are protecting habitat for the monkeys. But even though we focused on the monkeys, that forest is good for everybody else. It's good for the pumas that are coming back into the reserve. It's good for the snakes. It's good for the deer. It's good for the macaws and the toucans and all the amazing wildlife there. So, you know, basically the forest is helping many other species, but it's also providing us humans with water, clean air, and a better, more stable environment. If we don't care about that, we need to connect with the fact that just watch the news in any given day and see all the floodings, the fires, the slides, the everything that's happening because we have not planned land right. And we're screwing up in making wrong decisions based on economy, not necessarily in the balance between economy and or development and nature. So what I would say, so what I wanted to get to is that what's good for the monkeys is good for everybody. So within Colombia, we're just trying to prove that this model works, that we can do it, you know, with development and just trying to procure better livelihoods for people. So at the end, it's for all of us because we'll have a more stable region and country and people that have a good chance to make a decent living. Now, if you're an international listener, do something for your community, for your landscape. If you have other wildlife, I mean, and I want to cite Dr. Jane Goodall, who left us a few weeks ago, that she got asked that question so many times. And she said, do something, whatever, but do something. And just one action, you know, just recycle in your home, use less energy, you know, donate to conservation organizations, you know, plant a tree. do something. It doesn't matter if it's little or big.
For that person that wants to do something, where can people learn more about Proyecto Titi?
Amazing.
And where can they, you know, will join your conservation community or become ambassadors?
So the best way to connect with us is social media. So at Proyecto Titi is the, we have Instagram and Facebook are our most active social media, but we also have our website, proyectott.com, and there's all our contact information is there. So if you want to kind of take a look, check it out, see what it is like. We try to post very frequently every other day, and we try to post like fun stuff. I mean, one thing, like you were saying at the beginning, Neil, and we want to give hope. So we want to connect people with positive emotions from our work, give them hope, and wanting them to get engaged, to connect with us. So, you know, go check it out. And if you're interested, there's a contact information. We can provide more information. We can lead you to, you know, information that is available on the internet about what we do. And there's many ways to collaborate. It could be a small collaboration. It could be a big collaboration. Everything adds. Everything is welcome. No contribution is small for us.
Looking ahead, what would you say is your vision for the next decade for Proyecto Titi? Let's not even just for the cotton top tamarinds, but for everything we've talked about today.
Well, I mentioned that we have three conservation sites. There is a great opportunity that we can connect two of those through a very large regional forest corridor. That's my dream. That's what I want to be able to achieve over the next 10 years by creating forest corridors and engaging communities to protect the forest. If we are successful, cotton tops will be safe.
I love that. And I honestly wish you guys the utmost success with that. And before we all head off, I would love to hear what your final message of hope is for everyone regarding the entirety of climate change conservation.
No, I think I would recommend listeners to just put some hope into your life. Find something that you feel enthusiastic about. There's a lot of issues, but there's a lot of people around the planet working to change that and make it a better world for all of us. So if get engaged. Go out and find out what's around you. Be a part of it. And most of our organizations, you know, just want to give people hope and want to send an optimistic message. So connect with people like us and you'll feel better and make sure that you'll feel that you have a purpose and you can join causes like ours.
Very well said. And I hope that if they did make it this far in listening and they have been engaged with our altered world so far, that they would have experienced a lot of these organizations. And I'm so excited to have brought them more learning about the incredible work that you are doing over in Colombia. So thank you so much, Rosamira, for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you to the listeners. And happy life.
And thank you all for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FLUNKINGMONKEY. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.